Okay, good evening, everyone. Our topic for tonight is Martin Luther and the Jews. Martin Luther is the granddaddy of the Protestant Reformation, not the first figure to challenge the Catholic Church religiously, but by far the most prominent and the founding figure of Lutheranism in Germany. He's most famous for his 95 thesis that he tacked onto the door of the church at Wittenberg, in which he railed against the Catholic Church's willingness to do sales of indulgences. That if you commit a sin, you do an Aveira, you just pay a couple of shekels to the church and they sell you an indulgence. And he thought that was a disgrace to religion. So he had his various ideas about what was wrong with Catholicism and how he would make Christianity better. But our concern for tonight is what did he think about the Jews? Prior to his arrival on the scene, he's born in 1483, dies in 1546. In the 15th century and in the early 16th century, before Luther's rise to stardom, Jews were seen as repudiators of Christianity. Over the last few weeks, we've discussed, what were the major topics in that era: money lending, the blood libel, plague, making Jews into scapegoats, expulsion from various parts of Western and Central Europe, including France in 1394, Spain in 1492, Portugal in 1497, the pure blood laws of the Iberian Peninsula. So things are not good for Jews in Western and Central Europe, and there are a whole host of places where they're not allowed to go. So Luther was influenced in his earlier years by a fellow from a generation or two prior by the name of Johann Reichlin. Reichlin studied with the Avad Sforno. He studied with the Mefarash Sforno. He was a Christian Kabbalist and a student of Hebrew, of the Talmud, and he vigorously defended the preservation of Jewish books. Why did he believe in the preservation of Jewish books? Because they were necessary for the understanding of the origins of Christianity, and they could be useful in missionizing to the Jews. But as a result of that, you have to protect the private individual property rights of Jewish people who possess copies of these sacred writings. And since they're going to keep better hold of it than the Christians are, let the Jews have their sacred works and we'll read them for our purposes. So he was interested intellectually and for scholarly purposes, but also for missionary work. Now, Luther will also become a student of the Bible and learn some Hebrew and have a period of time when he was favorably disposed towards the Jews, at least in so far as they could be potentially converted. And, at that stage of his career, interacting with Jews and their scholarship was something that was significant to him, but he would turn on that very quickly, and later in his life be very much opposed and want to destroy the Talmud. Okay, so the Reformation was to the Catholic Church what the Church was to Second Temple Judaism. That's how the early Protestants would describe it, that if the Church needed to be reformed because there were ills, moral ills, theological ills that had become ingrained into the edifice of the Church, and that the Reformation would solve those problems and provide a pristine and purified religion. Well, the corollary to that was 1500 years earlier, Second Temple Judaism, Proto-Rabbinic Judaism, Pharisaic Judaism has its theological ills, its moral ills. And so what's going to reform it and do better? The early church, the nascent church, Jesus and the apostles. Okay. So Luther, we're going to see, attacked the legalism of the Roman Church. He wants to have a more spiritual religion, Bible-oriented, and not the legalism of the Roman Church, with its pope, with its sale of indulgences, with its heavy-duty iconography, all sorts of theological ills that Luther sees in the church. But he attacks the Jews. What do the Jews have to do with him attacking the church? And the answer is, attacking the Jews was a proxy. The Jews were a proxy, a stand-in for the priestly cult of the Roman temple. Basically, if Judaism is overly legalistic, the halakha is such a burden and oppressive and doesn't, in his eyes, represent the will of God anymore. So neither does the legalism of the Roman Church and its super duper details no longer represent the will of God anymore. So you attack the Jews as a proxy for attacking the Roman Church when you can't get away with attacking the Roman Church because it's too dangerous. Whereas attacking the Jews is easy. You know, Judaism, you can kick around and nobody's going to get you into trouble. Okay. Luther thought that the Jews hadn't yet converted because the Roman temple was just as confining as the Jerusalem temple, but that they should and would convert to an evangelical church, the likes of which he was going to produce. Now, there's a question in the chat, how could Luther get such a great following? The answer is that there was sentiment in Germany that was hostile to the Catholic Church that was building up over time. And he was a nationalist, Luther, who added an angle to this whole thing beyond just the theology. People liked the idea of a nationalist German church. And of course, the Nazis would follow suit in their own way 400 years later. And we're going to get to that shortly. So 20 years later, after trying to convert the Jews and thinking that they would convert to his brand of evangelical faith, but they didn't. Jews are stubborn. So he gives up hope and comes to the view that God made them insensible to the truth, that God made them insensible to the truth. Okay, well, let's discuss early in his career. What was Martin Luther saying? So in the year 1523, Luther wrote a book or a pamphlet titled That Jesus Christ Was Born a Jew. What a chiddush! Jesus Christ was born a Jew. It's not a chiddush at all. Okay, but just saying that line in 1523 was somewhat controversial. Why? Because since the Jews had been so thoroughly badmouthed and demonized in the preceding few centuries, the idea that the founder of your faith, the human being who you identify as a quasi-godlike figure, Jesus, would have actually been a Jew when the Jew is anathemized, some people can't believe it at all. They think, oh, that can't be the case. So Luther, early in his career, says, no, Jesus Christ was a Jew. Well, he now talks about why it is that the Jews didn't convert and how prior efforts at gaining their baptism, why it failed. It says like this, absurd theologians defend hatred for the Jews. What Jew would consent to enter our ranks when he sees the cruelty and enmity we wreak on them, that in our behavior towards them, we less resemble Christians than beasts? So here, what Luther is saying is, we've been very bad. We've been very bad to these people, okay? We've been beast-like to them, tortured them, done horrific things. Of course they're not going to convert to our religion. If they had to gauge the value or the legitimacy of the religion on the basis of the decency of its practitioners, well, we failed abysmally, and the end results are obvious. Then he says, if I had been a Jew and had seen such dolts and blockheads govern and teach the Christian faith, I would sooner have become a hog than a Christian. So he's mocking his predecessors in the religion business, the priests, the pastors, the clergymen who in prior centuries had tried to get Jews to, you know, accept baptism. Well, those guys were idiots. Okay. Now, does a rabbi speak that way about prior generations of rabbis? We don't do that. I mean, even if you think a certain posek was wrong about a particular issue, you know, they're always Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Zichrona Livracha, Alav Hashalom. We don't disparage earlier generations of people who are on our own line of work. And yet here he is saying they were idiots. They were idiots. Okay. Now, they have dealt with the Jews as if they were dogs rather than human beings. They have done little else than deride them and seize their property. Ah, so Luther's onto something here. He says they were just bashing the Jews gratuitously and grabbing their money. And that may have been the whole point, to grab their money. We've learned over the past few weeks that much of the persecution, especially in the Black Death persecutions, really had nothing to do with the Black Death. It was just to take cash. Okay. When they baptized them, they showed them nothing of Christian doctrine or life, but only subject them to the popishness and mockery. If the apostles, who were also Jews, had dealt with us Gentiles as we Gentiles deal with the Jews, there would never have been a Christian among the Gentiles. Whoa. So this is a key line. This is a great line. What he's saying is that if the apostles of Jesus in the years 30, 40, 50, 60 of the common era had been as nasty to the Goyim as we Goyim are to the Jews now, there never would have been a big Christianity, because no Goy would have ever converted to Christianity. Is that a true statement? It probably is. Okay? The early apostles were extending their love to the would-be proselyte, whereas the church in subsequent generations extended only a death grip and a death stare at the Jew. When we are inclined to boast of our position as Christians, we should remember that we are but Gentiles, while the Jews are of the lineage of Christ. We are aliens and in-laws. They are blood relatives, cousins, and brothers of our Lord. Therefore, if one is to boast of flesh and blood, the Jews are actually nearer to Christ than we are. So this is an interesting point. The idea that lineage, close family connection, biological connection matters. Well, does it matter? I mean, people like to say, I'm a descendant of David HaMelech, or I'm a fifth generation from the Vilna Gaon, or I'm a seventh generation from the Baal Shem Tov. People like to say, I have a biological connection on the family tree to some major figure of the ancient past in religion. So here, Luther, a Christian theologian, saying, listen, Jesus was Jewish biologically, and the Jews are Jewish biologically. They're closer to him than we are. We're the cousins, we're the in-laws, or the aliens, and they're nuclear family members. So you got to cut them some slack, because they have this connection to their revered, revered Christian savior. If we really want to help them, we must be guided in our dealings with them, not by papal law, but by the law of Christian love. So here he gives a shtach to the church, to the Catholic Church. The papal law was nasty and violent and was never going to be successful at winning over large numbers of Jews, because it's with the threat, the stick, and not the carrot. Whereas good Christian love, the carrot, not the stick, will win people over, or at least so he thought at that point in time. He would be disappointed later, but at least that's what he thought then. We must receive them cordially and permit them to trade and work with us, that we may have occasion and opportunity to associate with us, hear our Christian teaching, and witness our Christian life. Okay, so remember, in an earlier session, actually in several earlier classes, we said that there were Christian theologians, and for that matter, monarchs, who came to the conclusion that we don't want to have the Jews around us. We don't want to have social intercourse with them. We want them behind ghetto walls, because they are going to pollute our morals and our values if we have to deal with them on any regular basis. So even if we don't kick them out completely, let them be cloistered in their own area. We don't have to interact with them. Whereas Luther is saying, no, we want to interact with them, because if we don't, they won't see the beauty of Christian life and they won't hear our teachings. It's like Orthodox Jews, especially Hasidic Jews, like to speak of the beauty of our lifestyle, and that if only people knew how wonderful Shabbos was, and if they saw what a Shabbos table was, they would rush to be pious Jews. We can think that. It may not be true in all cases, but so here he's thinking the same thing. If they would only see how wonderful Christianity is by close contact with us, they would fall under our sway. Okay, that's what he thought. Okay. Now, if some of them should prove stiff-necked, what of it? After all, we ourselves are not all good Christians either. Whoa. So what he's saying is, we're going to win some people over. We may not win them all over. Some of them will be stiff-necked. Am kishay orif, like right out of the Torah. The Golden Calf episode. Am kishay orifu. But if we don't win them all, so we don't win them all. We're not all perfect Christians. So they also won't be all perfect Christians. But we'll win some of them. That's his perspective early in his career. That seems very nice and pleasant, at least for the moment. We'll see how all this changes and becomes a whole lot worse. So Luther was unsuccessful in converting people, very much unsuccessful. And that changed his attitude. and he began to pressure governments to do harm to Jewish rights, political rights. He campaigned successfully to have the Jews expelled from Saxony, Brandenburg, and Silesia. In 1537, Rabbi Yossel of Rosheim appealed to Luther for help because the Jews were being expelled from Saxony, or not even being allowed to cross into Saxony on business purposes or just to pass through. So Yossel of Rosheim was a classic shtadlan of the late medieval period, you know, the intercessor, the wealthy Jew who talks to the government, who talks to prominent Christians and seeks, you know, begs for some kind of concession. And he begged for Luther to appeal to the elector of the district not to implement this law. And what did Luther say? I'm not going to help you. Why? Because kindness towards the Jew is appropriate, but if and only if it's going to lead to a correction in their theological errors. But if it's going to sustain them in their errors, then I won't do it. So basically, chesed, kindness, is only for missionary purposes. Then it has its place. But lishma, just for its own sake, for the pure sake of decent humanity, I'm not going to do that because it helps you sustain your current errors of preserving Judaism. So that's his perspective. Now, in 1543, 3 years before Luther died, he wrote his two major works, which were hostile towards Jews. The first one was On the Jews and Their Lies, which was a 65,000 word treatise going deep into the weeds of hostility to Jews and, you know, invective hurled against them. And then the second book he wrote in 1543 was a shorter book on the unknowable name and the generations of Christ. The Germanic name was von Shem HaMeforash. It was about the Shem HaMeforash, which in Hebrew is, you know, the ineffable name of God. And it was basically pure sacrilege, mocking the Jewish approach towards the Shem Hashem. Okay. Then, in the last year of his life, in 1546, so Norman's asking how long after his first defense of the Jews did this happen? About 20 years. Okay, and the question is, why was he so obsessed with converting Jews? The answer is he wasn't so obsessed with converting them. At some point, he realized he wasn't going to. He just thought that he would be able to because of the brilliance and improved version of his Christian faith. If he's hoping to win over the Catholics, he's hoping to win over everybody. Okay, so in the last year of his life, he had four final sermons in which he warned the secular authorities of the need to expel Jews, unconverted Jews, that they kill us, that they poison us, that even their doctors are poisoning us with potions that will kill you after a week, a month, a year, or 10 years, but that they cannot be trusted in any way. Therefore, the Jews have to be expelled. In the 1570s and 80s, long after Luther died, Jews were expelled from several Lutheran states, but no leader ever carried out Luther's full anti-Semitic program. And I'm going to read to you the full program. It's a 7-part program. We're going to spend the next 20, 30 minutes, you know, going through it in detail. So he writes it. He advocates for the expulsion of Jews while he's alive. And then after his death and subsequent decades, it does happen in wide swaths of Germany. In 1612, there's a pogrom in Frankfurt where 3,000 Jews are killed, and it's inspired by a reprinting of On the Jews and Their Lies, the 1543 work of Luther. And in 1938, Kristallnacht happens on Luther's birthday, November 10th, 1938. So November 10th was Luther's birthday. No coincidence right there. So the Nazis loved citing Luther as their predecessor. Defenders of Luther would argue that he was never a racialist and that this was always about religion. This was purely religious anti-Judaism or even anti-Semitism, but not biological, racial in character. His detractors would argue that, well, you could claim that. You could claim it's all religious and not racial. But the bottom line is that his rage was kindled against an identifiable group of humans, not just a religious concept or idea or point of view. Luther's writings did not have continuous popularity. In his own time, they were not widely read. Now, his general writings were widely read, but his writings specifically on Jews were not so widely read. And they were reprinted a little bit in the early 1600s, but then for about 200 years, 250 years, they were not reprinted at all. They were felt dormant and then brought back in the 1930s by the Nazis. But even though the works themselves were not reprinted necessarily, the sentiment about, you know, hatred towards the Jew and the demonization of the Jew took root in Germany. And that was Luther's doing. Nazi anti-Semitism was far more popular in Lutheran regions of Germany than it was in Catholic regions of Germany. And that should not be overlooked, that as much as we might, you know, have a problem with the Catholic Church, still the Lutheran Church was more viciously anti-Jewish in the Germanic sense of it than was the Catholic Church. So let's now get to some of what Luther had to say on the Jews and their lies. So first off, he says, you don't want to get into a debate with Jews. You really don't want to. You don't want to enter an argument with them. If it's possible to avoid it, avoid it. So why does he come to that conclusion? Because he sees that Jews have been stiff-necked and have not yielded to what he regarded as compelling arguments. So if Jews are not going to yield to compelling arguments, then you're wasting your breath talking to them. But if you have to, he says, this is the trump card. Listen to this one. If it's impossible to avoid, this is what you should say. Listen, Jew, don't you know that Jerusalem and your kingdom, the temple and your ministry, were destroyed over 1460 years ago? Give this nut to the Jews and let them break their teeth on it and dispute as much as they like. For the cruelty of divine wrath shows all too clearly that they are surely in error and on the wrong path. A child would understand this. So basically, you tell the Jew, if you're a Christian who has to deal with a Jew, you tell the Jew, listen, Jew, your people lost a long, long time ago. Your temple is gone. It proved God doesn't like you. It's over, buddy. Get over it. So as far as Luther is concerned, this one piece of line of argumentation is so obvious that even a child, a 7-8-year-old child, would appreciate it. And yet the Jew still doesn't appreciate it. So that's what annoys him. So Luther engages in lusty diatribes with torrential outpourings of passion, of hostility towards the Jews. More so than any other writer, he gets down in the gutter, writing absolute filth, foul language, inappropriate for a clergyman, but he does it. He does it against the Jew. Now he writes an interesting point about the Jews being foreigners. Now, if this this strikes a chord as being consistent with some of what you heard from the Nazi era, then yes, because it makes there is this connection. In truth, the Jews being foreigners should possess nothing. What they do possess should be ours. Here, what they possess should be ours. Whatever they have shouldn't really belong to them. They leached it off of us. They're parasites. They're mooching off of us. For they do not work, and we do not give them presents. Nevertheless, they keep our money and our goods and have become our masters in our own country and their dispersion. So this already was from the days of the Romans, this idea that the Jews are in the dispersion, and yet they're giving laws to the host country. That the Jew, as a beleaguered minority, is not a beleaguered minority, is actually a boss in the Chutz La'aretz. That's how Luther felt. That's how Cicero felt back in Roman times, that the conquered have given laws to the conquerors. When a thief steals 10 guldens, he is hanged. But when a Jew steals 10 barrels of gold through usury, he is prouder than the Lord himself. You can just imagine the image in Luther's mind of a Jewish moneylender sitting at his desk, not breaking a sweat, having never lifted anything heavier than a pen in his life, but writing in his ledger, Goy owes me $50, $50,000, must pay by September 25th. Come September 25th, Goy comes in, gives me a lot of money, boom, put it in my pocket. What does the Goy feel? Ah, this guy made money doing nothing. He boasts of it and strengthens his faith and hatred of us and thinks, see how the Lord does not abandon his people in a dispersion. We do not work. We are idle, and we pass the time pleasantly. The cursed Goyim must work for us, and we have their money. Thus we are their lords, and they are our servants. Now, the Jews never really thought that way. No Jew ever thought that way. But in the mind of Luther, that's what the Jew is thinking. That the Jew thinks to himself, I have it great. I don't work, I don't break a sweat, and I get all this cash. Goyish cash. Okay. So, what's the solution as far as Luther is concerned? What ought to happen to these people? So he has an idea. He says like this. To this day, we still do not know what devil brought them to our country. So he doesn't know the history of how Jews came to Central Europe and Northern Europe. Surely we did not go seek them out in Jerusalem. Meaning, we the Europeans didn't go to the Middle East and say, Jews, we want you. Of course not, okay? But it's a little more complicated than that. The truth is some European countries did welcome Jews. And in fact, Bedafka welcomed them for their financial abilities and out of the need for money lending, knowing that the Jews alone could accomplish that task because Christians can't engage in usury. So he's a little bit wrong historically, but the sentiment is, you know, we didn't want these people here. We didn't go to Jerusalem looking for the Jews. What are they doing here? But now that they're here, what do we do with them? So no one wants them. The countryside and the roads are open to them. They may return to their country when they wish. Aha! Luther is suggesting kibbutz galuyot, Zionism. So here, anti-Semitism and Zionism go hand in hand. Remember a couple of years ago when we learned about Zionism, I said the more anti-Semitic a country, the more likely it was for at least elements of their political elite to favor Zionism, because it's a way of getting rid of the Jews. You have a Jewish problem, you have a Jewish solution. Okay? Then we shall gladly give them presents to get rid of them. For they are a heavy burden on us, a scourge, a pestilence, a misfortune for our country. Now I muted everybody, and I'm too lazy to unmute you, but if I would unmute you, I'd ask you, what pasuk in the Torah does that remind you of? Actually, you know what? I'm not so lazy. I'm gonna unmute give you the opportunity to unmute. Allow participants to unmute. What pasuk in the Torah does that remind you of? Correct, correct. Good. Yitziat Mitzrayim. Klei kesef uklei zahavu smalot. That the Egyptians were ready to give them gold and silver and clothing. Just get out of here. We want you gone as fast as possible. And it says, Vayinatzlu et Mitzrayim. They cleaned out Egypt of all their possessions. Okay, good. So, that's, you know, what Luther is saying. We wish they were gone, and we'd even gladly give them stuff to get them out of here. Then he says, recently the Jews have been expelled by force from a whole lot of countries, from France, Tsarfat, from Spain, Sfarad, from Bohemia, from Ratisbonne, Magdeburg, other places in the Germanic provinces. So what Luther is suggesting is, you listen, expelling the Jews is no radical solution. It's already been done 5 or 6 times already. So if the other German principalities want to do it, no kol hakavod to them. They're just following suit of other European countries who did the right thing. Okay. Well, then he has this point. We the Christians are righteous, whereas the Jews are evil in that they did bad things to us. They mock us, and they mock our faith, and they do practical things which are injurious to our health and well-being. So I'll quote him. We do not call their wives whores, as they do Mary, the mother of Jesus. We do not call their children sons of whores, as they do the Lord Jesus Christ. So what he's saying is the Jews, they mock Yeshu, and Virgin Mary, okay, they say that she's a prutza, that she's a zona, that he's a mamzer. All the invective of the Torah is applied by Jews to the heroes of, you know, Christian mythology. And he's right. We absolutely do that. The Toldos Yeshu is full of 1,000 pages of that stuff. and the sermons and the private conversations the Jews have, Arayom Azeh, till this very day, we make fun of the religious beliefs of the other team. Whether we should or we shouldn't is beside the point. The bottom line is we do it, okay? And the Goyim know that we do it. So his response is, well, we don't do that to you guys. We're not calling you a Zona or a Prutza or a Mamzer. We may call you the devil or, it's Am Kishay Oref, but we didn't say the sorts of things that you said. Then we do not curse them. We wish them all the good in the world, in the flesh and in the spirit. We give them shelter, let them eat and drink with us. We do not carry off and kill their children, nor poison their wells, nor slake our thirst with their blood. Well, he's saying the Christians don't do that to the Jews. What he's implying is the Jews do it to the Christians. So in one sentence, what did he just do? He confirmed his belief in the blood libel, in the well poisonings of the bubonic plague era, and ritual murder. So all the canards of the previous few centuries, Luther is saying, yeah, it's all true. It's all true. Or at least he's implying that it's all true, if not saying so explicitly. Does he really know? Does he really believe that it's true? Or does he think that it's false, but a convenient means by which to pummel his opponents? I'm not really sure. Could be he believed it with his whole heart. I really don't know. Really don't know. Okay. Now, let's go to some of his choicest quotes. He says the following. Therefore, the blind Jews are truly stupid fools. So the notion that the Jews are blind is a play on words. Who can tell me how is it a play on words to say that the Jews are blind? I allowed you to unmute if you want to unmute. Play on words. Jews are blind. Hebrew, folks. Elementary level Hebrew. Come on, who knows it? Ivrim and Ivrim, spelled differently. Ein, Bet, Resh, Yud, Mem, Hebrews, Jews, and Ivrim. Ein, Vav, Resh, Yud, Mem, blind people. That the Jews have rendered themselves blind to theological truths. And so, as good as we are at missionary work, with other types of people, and we'll toot our own horns, how we can convince people of the truths of our doctrines, we're not going to convince the Jews because they have blinded themselves. Then, now, just behold these miserable, blind, and senseless people. Their blindness and arrogance are as solid as an iron mountain. So the arrogance of the Jews, the ga'ava, the arrogance of the Jew, is something that bothered Luther. Now, what's so annoying about arrogance on the part of Jews from the perspective of late medieval Christian theologians? The answer is that the Jew is the bottom of the barrel. The Jew is at the bottom of society. He's the beleaguered minority. What business does he have being arrogant? We should be arrogant that we're on top and he's on the bottom. And yet they turn it on its head and they're arrogant. And that flustered a guy like Luther. Then, learn from this, dear Christian, what you are doing. If you permit the blind Jews to mislead you, then the saying will truly apply. When a blind man leads a blind man, both will fall into the pit. You cannot learn anything from them except how to misunderstand divine commandments. The only thing you can learn from the Jew is how to misunderstand the mitzvot. That what he's saying is the Jews don't teach the correct interpretation of the scriptures, that he does. With his translation, his perushim, but the Jew always gets it wrong. And if you listen to the Jew, you're going to learn false interpretations of the Bible. Then, nothing but thieves and robbers they are, who eat daily no morsel of bread and wear no thread of clothing which they have not stolen or pilfered from us by means of accursed usury. So here the accusation is that the Jews are all thieves. Not just that they have theological error, that they don't believe in Christ, and they believe in the binding character of the Mosaic Law, but that they're a bunch of ganavim, that they're immoral, that they steal from us. Then, they lie clumsily. He doesn't trust the Jew. The Jew is a speaker of falsehoods. Then, They have been inventing their lies for longer than 2,000 years. This I find fascinating. The idea that it's been more than 2,000 years and the Jews have been telling falsehoods in the religious realm. Remember, he's writing this in the year 1543. So Jesus was only 1,500 years earlier, not 2,000 years earlier. Why the, you know, the Shnot Alpayim? Because what he's saying is that even Second Temple Judaism was a farce, was wrong. That the era of Hillel and Shammai, the era of the Zugot, the era of Ezra HaSofer, all that was bad. That already from Second Temple times and onward, the Jews are doing wrong. Then, eject them forever from this country. For as we have heard, God's anger is with them so intense that gentle mercy will only tend to make them worse and worse, while sharp mercy will reform them but little. Therefore, in any case, away with them. So here he's saying, don't have rachmanut on the Jews. Rachmanus, mercy, don't do it. You may be tempted as a matter of human decency to be kindly disposed towards the beleaguered Jew. But don't do it. Why? Because if you're gentle with them, they'll just become even more incorrigible. And if you're sharp with them, a little tough love, it will only reform them a little bit because they're basically a lost cause. So don't bother trying. Just get rid of them. Cast them out of the country. Over and over, we let them get rich on our sweat and blood, while we remain poor. And they suck the marrow of our bones. They suck the marrow of our bones. So this was both metaphorical and literal. The sucking of the marrow of the bones is, an allusion to ritual murder. Do the Protestants, like the Catholics, have the prohibition of charging interest? Yes, they do, although it was never adhered to fully. But it was done away with eventually after mercantilism became popular. But by the 17th century, plenty of Christians were charging usury. But in theory, the Protestants began with a similar approach of opposing usury as immoral. Okay, so the Jew sucks the marrow from our bone is metaphorical, but also literal. That they're literally drinking our lifeblood. He says, don't give the Jews any safe harbor. Do not grant them protection, safe conduct, or communion with us. So this was, you may kick the Jews out of the country, like you can't live here anymore. But what about letting them pass through from one place to another? Is that allowed? He says, even that shouldn't be allowed. Not a single Jew should tread anywhere on this soil. Luther had another line in which he encourages the Christian, the good evangelical Christian, the Protestant Christian, to create in his own mind an image of the Jew. Let the government deal with them in this respect, as I have suggested. But whether the government acts or not, let everyone at least be guided by his own conscience and form for himself a definition or image of the Jew. So he wants you to paint a picture in your mind of the most grotesque and ugly, vile being, and that is the Jew. And once you create that image in your mind, you will agree with all the hostile measures that... Because if you think of the Jew as this other human being who's just as much of the Tselem Elohim as you are, then you'll be opposed to, government hostility, or government persecution of the Jew, but not if the Jew is a real dastardly figure. Okay, then, do not extend to them basic kindness. We must avoid confirming them their wanton lying. We dare not make ourselves partners in their devilish ranting and raving by shielding and protecting them, by giving them food, drink, and shelter, or by other neighborly actions. So basic things like giving somebody a glass of water, a piece of food to eat. This is what Luther opposes. And I'm reminded of a scene in one of the episodes of War and Remembrance, which if you haven't seen it, watch Winds of War and War of Remembrance. Okay, Herman Wouk, watch the whole thing. You'll binge watch it. It'll take you about a month, but you'll watch the whole thing. In one of the episodes, when Aaron Jastrow is on the train to Auschwitz, so the train stops, and they're all thirsty and hungry, and they open up the cattle car doors. And someone extends a bushel of apples to all the Jews and gives one to Jastrow and says, I'm a Christian. as though being a Christian means you'll do a chesed, a kindness, to a stranger, even to a Jew, just as a matter of human decency. What Luther is saying is, no, 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 don't do that. Do nothing of human kindness to the Jew. That's pretty nasty stuff. Then, what are the seven agenda items that Luther has? Let's now get to the meat of the matter. Number one, first, set fire to their synagogues or schools, and to bury and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever again see a stone or cinder of them. Now that's Kristallnacht right there. On his birthday, 1938, burn down the shuls. Okay? Then, number two, I advise that their houses also be razed and destroyed. So not only the synagogues, but even the private homes of Jews, destroy them. For they pursue in them the same aims as in the synagogue. Now, that's an interesting point. Where's the locus of Judaism? I wrote about this in my essay last Shabbos. The locus of Judaism is supposed to be the home, the Bayit HaYehudi, not the political party in Israel, but you know, the Jewish home. All right. The synagogue is where we have public worship. But where do we do most of our mitzvot? Where does a Jew really live as a Jew? In his own home. So Luther knows that, and he says, destroy the private homes too. Okay? Instead, they might be lodged under a roof or in a barn, like the gypsies. The fact that Jews are being relegated to the same status as gypsies reminds you of what? Well, Nazism. So here again, the Jews, gypsies being persecuted, Luther is a forerunner to the Nazis. They will bring home to them that they are not masters in our country, as they boast, but they are living in exile and captivity, as they incessantly wail and lament about us before God. So what he's saying is, the Jews are always complaining, we don't have a home. Well, we'll make sure you really don't have a home. Number three, I advise that all their prayer books and Talmudic writings, in which such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy are taught, be taken from them. So the confiscation of Jewish books, well, again, if you remember from the Nazi era, the confiscation and burning of Jewish books. So unlike Reichlin, who was his Rebbe from the prior time, who favored the preservation of Hebraica and Judaica and Talmudic volumes, Luther says, we don't need this stuff anymore. This stuff is just hostile to Christianity. It's full of stuff that we think is heresy. So let's destroy it, confiscate it from them and get rid of it. Fourthly, I advise that their rabbis be forbidden to teach henceforth, on pain of loss of life and limb. Now, loss of life and limb reminds you of what story that may or may not be a historically true story, but we recall every year. I allowed you to unmute. What story is that?
Rav Amnon,
bingo. Rav Amnon. And Unastana Tokev, Rosh Hashanah Yikai Sevun. Okay, we say it every year, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and in the footnote at the bottom of the Machzor tells the Suri, Kolonis ben Meshulam, and Rav Amnon. Okay, so you know what? If the rabbis are going to teach, we're going to chop off their arms and legs. That's what he's saying. For they have forfeited the right to such an office by holding the poor Jews captive with the saying of Moses, in which he commands them to obey their teachers on penalty of death. Okay? L'tasum en devar sh'yigil l'chaim en usmol. So it says in Deuteronomy, you got to say follow what the authorities tell you to do, whether they go left or right, yamin or small. So here Luther is claiming that the rabbis took advantage of Deuteronomy to give the Jews improper guidance, knowingly incorrect guidance and false interpretations of the scriptures to lead them to religious oblivion. So what should we do to the rabbis? Basically chop them to pieces if they're going to continue to teach. Okay. Now, then, number five, I advise that safe conduct on the highways be abolished completely for the Jews, for they have no business in the countryside, since they are not lords, officials, tradesmen, or the like. Let them stay at home. This is a curious idea. What happens is the Jews at that time lived in urban centers, or at least towns. They were not really living in the countryside because they did not till the soil. They were not farmers, agriculturalists. So what business did they have doing going on the highways in between the towns or going off in the yonder in the countryside? Well, basically just to collect, you know, the monies owed to them. So we don't want to see them. We don't want them collecting their monies. Therefore, keep them in the towns where they already are. Don't give them any safe passage on the roads. There were times when it wasn't safe to be a Jew on the roads, especially at the height of pogroms and various crusades. If you were an isolated Jew in the middle of nowhere, you were an easy target. So the government was supposed to provide a certain safe passage in the sense that the Jews were under the protection of the monarch. But what Luther is saying is, if you're the elector, you're the governor, you're the duke, whatever, this is your domain, don't give safe passage anymore. And then they'll be targeted and they'll be killed. Number six, I advise that usury be prohibited to them, and that all cash and treasure of silver and gold be taken from them and put aside for safekeeping. So basically rob them blind. That the Jews are engaged in the money business, take away their money, and don't let them engage in the money business anymore. Okay? The reason for this measure is that they have no other means of earning a livelihood other than usury, and by it they have stolen and robbed us all of our possessions. Such money should now be used in no other way than the following. Whenever a Jew is sincerely converted, he should be handed 100, 200, 300 florins based upon personal circumstances. So basically, confiscate all the money that the Jews have and give incentive program. If you convert to become a goy, to become a Christian, we'll give you from this pot of gold that was confiscated from the collective body of Jewry. And now, isn't that a conversion for improper reasons, without real sincere conviction? It's just for the sake of financial gain. Is that a kosher conversion? If a person converted to Judaism with that same motivation, would we recognize them as Jewish and give them an aliyah and shul? I don't think so. So why does Luther want that for baptism purposes? Well, the answer is very simple, because he has no other way of winning them over. Doctrinal considerations alone and belief in dogma has not won over the Jews, but maybe a little bit of abyssal bribery, and that'll get the job done. Okay, now we go to number seven. Number seven. I commend putting a flail, an axe, a hoe, a spade, a distaff, or a spindle into the hands of young, strong Jews and Jewesses, and let them earn their bread by the sweat of their brow, as was imposed upon the children of Adam, B'zeata pecha tocha lechem, Genesis chapter 3, verse 19. Now, this is very interesting. What Luther has suggested in two different places is basically the ideology of David Ben-Gurion. He says, Shivat Zion, go back to Zion, and when you get to Zion, what ought a Jew do? Till the soil. So, working the land and going back to your homeland are two agenda items that Luther has for Jews. That they were not said with love and affection, but they happen to correspond somewhat neatly with late 19th and early 20th century ideology of people who we admire. Okay, but he continues. For it is not fitting that they should let us accursed goyim toil in the sweat of our faces while they, the holy people, idle away their time behind the stove, feasting and farting on top of it all, boasting blasphemously of their lordship over Christians by means of our sweat. No, one should toss out these lazy figures by the seat of their pants. So vulgarity, of course, and desire for expulsion. So what he's saying is, we don't want to have a situation continue where we're working hard. We, the Gentiles, produce the food. We work, by the sweat of our brow. But the Jew is a lazy bum, and he makes his parnassa doing essentially nothing. That's not fair. It has to come to an end. It will come to an end if you coerce them into manual labor. Okay? Instead of the white-collar professions, make them do some manual labor. Okay. Well, the last piece of the puzzle, after the seven agenda items, is where he says something that really reminds me of Joseph Mengele. He says, I wish and ask that our rulers who have Jewish subjects exercise a sharp mercy towards these wretched people. Okay, so he's encouraging the secular authorities. Remember, he's a religious figure. Religious figures don't control the government, they don't control policy. They can encourage, by force of their persuasion and religious significance to the secular authorities to do something, but the temporal authorities must act. He says, I want you guys to be tough with these people. They must act like a good physician who, when gangrene has set in, proceeds without mercy to cut, saw, and burn flesh, veins, bones, and marrow. Such a procedure must also follow in this instance. Burn down their synagogues, and so on and so forth. So he wants the government to function like a doctor with a gangrene patient, to cut away the unhealthy tissue and discard it. So what's the unhealthy tissue in Christian society, in Christendom of 16th century Middle Europe? The answer, the Jew who won't convert, who stays loyal to the synagogue. Drive them out like mad dogs. So that's the end of his treatise. Now, his other book about the Shema Mephorash has an interesting picture. I'll show you the picture. I printed it out. I don't know if you can see it so well, but this was on the title page of Shema Mephorash. It's a cat. It's a pig, a mother pig, and there are baby pigs, little piglets, sucking, nursing on the mother pig. And a rabbi is by the rear end, by the tush of the pig, lifting up its leg to see what's underneath. And what's underneath is a copy of the Talmud. And what Luther says is the following. Here in Wittenberg, our parish church, there is a sow carved into the stone under which lie young pigs and Jews who are sucking. Behind the sow stands a rabbi who is lifting up the right leg, raises behind the sow, bows down and looks with great effort into the Talmud, as if he wanted to read and see something most difficult and exceptional. No doubt they gained their Shema Mephorash from that place, that the Shema Mephorash, the name of God, was gained by looking in the filth of a pig. So that's about as hostile to Jewish belief as you can get with a pretty grotesque statement. Okay, well, enough about that. In what way was Luther paving the way for Hitler? So in two very critical respects. One, he encouraged unconditional obedience to the authorities. Now, notice I say the authorities. I don't say the religious authorities because, in fact, he was a rebel himself. He overturned the power of the church, of the Roman Catholic Church. But he believes in obedience to the secular authority. He wants to mold in his image, but obedience. And secondly, identification with a German national prophet. That's him. He is the German national prophet. The Lutheran Church was bedafka for Germany, specifically for the Germanic-speaking lands. And he was not really appealing to other places. So that's Hitler. Unconditional obedience to the secular authorities and identification with this national prophet who in Hitler's eyes was himself, that his national socialism, his dogma was, you know, for this, the salvation of Germany. So that is the real connection. The Nazis loved citing Luther. It was very convenient for them to do so. And there was, you know, there was some pushback within the Lutheran Church. There were some scholars and theologians in the 1930s within the Lutheran camp who objected to the, what they would regard as the misappropriation of Luther's writings for the sake of racial anti-Semitism. But those voices were drowned out because they were a minority in a sea of a whole lot of Jew hatred. Okay. Now, last point for tonight is that Luther himself basically went bonkers. He went nuts towards the end. He was not rational. He was not sane. He had authentic religious anguish, but he had hallucinations. He saw the devil everywhere. And at some points, he became steeped in blasphemy, even by his own standards, confusing where God is and where the devil is. So, and listen, the Catholic Church regarded him as a heretic just from day one, from 1517. But even some of the Protestants who were appreciative of his efforts to overturn the power of the Catholic Church saw that in the last years of his life, he wasn't thinking clearly. And part of his not thinking clearly was the super duper venom that he hurled towards the Jew. The Jew wasn't the only target, but one of the most significant targets. Okay, now I'll take some questions.
Question from the time of Luther to the time of Hitler.
Yeah.
There seems to have not been any effect of Luther, because you had the Haskalah, you had the emancipation, and that was a big thing until Hitler came back.
So Germany, and we're going to spend a lot of time over the next few months on German anti-Semitism in the modern era. German anti-Semitism, religious anti-Semitism, is fairly strong in the 1600s, in the 1700s, and it's not easy for the enlightened, for the Haskalah figures to break into German society. They would like to, but the Haskalah is really an internal Jewish development. There's not much of an interaction with the Gentile world. There were a handful of people who had favorable relations with Mendelssohn or David Friedlander, and we'll talk about that. And we have in past courses, but it was an internal Jewish development to become secularized and to turn towards a newer understanding of the Jewish heritage. But the Goyim still didn't like the Jews, all right? Lavater and the others. Now, as for this, the Christian Enlightenment, some of the Christian Enlightenment figures wanted a more friendly or charitable approach of government towards the Jews, towards emancipation, but plenty of others rejected emancipation of the Jew and said, no, he's not up to the challenge. But they could be progressive thinkers on other facets of life, but still wanted to hold back the Jew. So we'll have to talk about that. But it's not as though there was tremendous progress all throughout the period from 1540s to the 1930s, and then it was suddenly reversed. There was element. Progress from, let's say, the 1780s and then 1871, immediately there's a backlash with Wilhelm, etc. So it was never especially good. There was a brief moment where things might have looked good, but it was very brief.
Question.
Yeah.
Question. There was no doctrine like St. Augustine that to keep the Jews alive as a as a witness to
not in Luther's thinking. Luther would have been very happy if Jews ceased to exist on the face of the earth.
So he was
He was genocidal or not is a separate matter. I'm not going to ascribe that to him because he never actually says it so explicitly. But he was more of the expulsionist variety. But certainly there is no necessary place for Jews in his religious worldview.
So in a way, he's more extreme than the church.
More extreme than the church had been, correct?
Right. Okay.
Which is exactly why we get to spend a session on him in a course in anti-Semitism. Had he been more watered down than the church, I would have glossed over him. It's bedafka because he ups the ante that we have to talk about him.
Was there any antagonism between him and the secular rulers? Did the secular rulers accept a lot of what he said? Because, as you said before, many times Jews were important to.
Okay, so the answer is that in his own time, he was successful in certain places, Saxony, Brandenburg, Silesia, of getting the electors and dukes to expel Jews. Other places, not. But, a few places is a few too many, as far as I'm concerned. And after his death, others took that example and followed along with it. So there were substantial parts of Germany where it was Judenrein in the 16th century and into the early 17th century. We think of German Jewry as being a substantial community, on the eve of the emancipation, and it was, but they were not so evenly distributed. There were areas where they had not been for a while.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it, in general, there was a feeling against Talmudic rabbinic Judaism as opposed to biblical Judaism? In other words,
yes. So here's the thing. We're going to talk next time, I believe, about Eisenmenger and Judaism Unmasked and Sanctus Judentum, in which he combs through the Talmud for all sorts of unpleasant things that he could accuse the Jews of, Talmudic Judaism was seen as devilish.
Yes.
Biblical religion was seen as okay, but let's bear in mind this important point, that the law, Mosaic law, was rejected by the church. But the Catholic Church nonetheless preserved elements of the law in their own way. They twisted it, but they preserved some of it. Luther is saying, preserve even less. You know, let's get rid of some of the legalisms of the Catholicism and get to an even more spiritual and, you know, abstractly biblical religion. There are other Protestants who took a different approach. The Calvinists, as opposed to the Lutherans, they adopted the third usage of the law, the idea of not Judaism, not Catholicism, but rather preserve the law in slightly amended form. So, for example, you observe Shabbos, no working on the holy day. In Calvinist religion, you can't work on Shabbos, except Shabbos is on Sunday. They'll change the Sabbath to the Sunday, but you can't work. No malacha. And that's why in certain parts of Western Europe, it was like really frowned on to, you know, bale your hay on Sunday, as opposed to in other types of Christianity where there's no Isur Malacha on the holy day. So the approach towards the law differed even within Protestantism.
Were the Calvinists less extreme than Lutheran?
Okay, so the Calvinists in certain countries, in the Low Countries, tended to be less anti-Semitic than the Lutherans, in part because they were a minority at first. And as a minority, they feel bad for a fellow beleaguered minority. But also they lacked some of the venom that Luther was spreading. So the Calvinists, we have issues with them too. But in certain places, they were far more tolerant than were the Lutherans. Now, we'll stop here. I wanted to answer Hillel's question. Did Martin Luther have other groups he hated beside the Jews and the Catholics? And the answer is, those were the main ones. He didn't like gypsies too much either. He didn't like Mohammedans, Muslims. I mean, he had plenty of groups that he didn't like, but because his main goal was to undermine the Catholic Church, and he could do that sort of indirectly by undermining rabbinic Judaism. So those were the two main targets of his arrows. Okay. See everybody next week. Hopefully we'll be in person. All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.